Today at Reader's Corner, we welcome one of our favorite authors, New York Times columnist Tim Egan, to talk about his latest book, A Pilgrimage to Eternity, From Canterbury to Rome in Search of a Faith. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Tim Egan's latest book, A Pilgrimage to Eternity, is a fascinating journey, a family story, and a revealing history of Christianity and the world it created. Moved by his Catholic family's complicated history with the church, Timothy Egan decided to follow in the footsteps of centuries of seekers to force a reckoning with his own beliefs, embarking on a 1,000-mile pilgrimage through the theological cradle of Christianity. He sets out along the Via Frangenia, once the major medieval trail leading the devout to Rome, and travels overland via the small mountain towns of France, Switzerland, and Italy, accompanied by a quirky cast of fellow pilgrims. The New York Times said of the book, a deeply researched, captivating journey through the rich history of Christianity and the winding paths of the French and Italian countrysides that will feed mind, body, and soul. Tim Egan is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and the author of 8 books, most recently, The Immortal Irishman, a New York Times bestseller. His book on the Dust Bowl, The Worst Hard Time, won a National Book Award for nonfiction. He writes a weekly column for the New York Times. At the 2016 Boise State University Spring Commencement, Tim addressed the graduates, and I was honored to recognize Tim with an honorary doctorate for his contribution to the humanities. Tim Egan, great to have you back at Reader's Corner.
Hey, Bob, great to be back with you, and I cherish both that honorary doctorate and that the memory of that wonderful commencement speech in the spring when we could all gather.
Exactly. Yeah, weren't those the days?
Yeah.
Well, they loved having you, and they loved your remarks, and we're just delighted to have you back. This time, Francigena. Is that how you say it? Via Francigena?
You came pretty close. So I'm going to give you a B on that.
Uh-huh.
Via Francigena.
Via Francigena. Okay,
right.
Great. You know, after 5 years of Latin, you'd think I'd be able to figure that one out on my own.
You would.
Yeah, but anyway, it's been a long time. So tell us, how long did it take you to do this?
So the journey itself, this is just to give your listeners an overview of this thing. Most people know about the Camino de Santiago, which is the better known pilgrimage trail, mostly through Spain. This is lesser known, but actually was the premier pilgrimage route for a millennium. And it's arguably way more full of history and certainly way more scenic. I found it just full of magic and wonder and awe and surprise and drama and all the great things you look for in a journey almost every step of the way. It's about 1,000 miles, a little more. It starts in Canterbury, ends up in Rome. So you have to cross the English Channel, and then you basically walk all the way through. The Francigena part of it means through France, via Francigena, the way through France, because that forms the major part of it. But then you go through all the mountains of Switzerland, you crest St. Bernard, Great St. Bernard Pass at above 8,000 feet, where I ran into a snowstorm in August. Then you wind all the way down the Italian Alps, and you go through glorious Tuscany, you end up in Rome. And I broke it up into 2 parts. I did it in the early spring for a whole section, got to midsummer. And then I had a personal issue I had to attend to. Someone I know and love very well was dying of cancer. And I was, you know, hoping for a miracle along the way was one of the things that it didn't happen. So I came home and then I went back and did the second part. So probably 3 months total on the trail and then about 2 years to write the book. The hardest thing for me was to throw myself back into the history of Christianity. You know, I'm a lapsed Catholic, which is, by the way, the fastest growing cohort. They say,
for sure.
You know, how do you identify yourself in American religious surveys? The fastest growing cohort is lapsed Catholic. So there's a lot of us. So the hardest thing for me in the research and taking the time was to throw myself back into all this history of Christianity and to open myself up as well. I didn't want to go in with any cynicism. I didn't want to go in with the hard, you know, preconceptions. I said, just erase, go in fresh and open-minded.
Well, you certainly did that. And I have to say to our listeners, this is a book where I learned so much. I mean, I had a minor in theology coming out of a Catholic college. And of course, I didn't think I knew it all. But your book just does such a great job of going back into the history of the church. It was very clear to me that you didn't learn all of this along the way. There's a lot of research in this book that allows the reader to learn way more than what you learned visiting the churches along the way.
Right. And that's a very important point. And by the way, thank you for your kind words on that. I defer to you, a minor in theology. I barely made it to my high school religious history classes at Gonzaga Prep, you know. No, there were two things I had to prepare for. And this is what anyone approaching and trying to do a pilgrimage should prepare for. You know, first is the physical thing, to get yourself in shape. And I've kept myself in fairly good shape, but I was, you know, running stairs and doing all kinds of just, you know, day hikes with a pack to prepare myself so I could handle this thing. That was the easy part. The harder part was preparing myself spiritually and intellectually. And so I did read a lot of these histories of the church. I did go back and sort of till the ground of the theology so that when I get to these places, I would understand it. I didn't just want to walk in cold and read the plaque on the side of the church and not understand what the wars of religion were or why Joan of Arc has such resonance, or what happened at Saint Maurice, where the first black saint is from the dating to the third century. Having all that background then helped me to, when I went there, these places had greater resonance.
Well, since the subtitle of your book is From Canterbury to Rome in Search of a Faith, let's start in Canterbury, the Archbishop of Canterbury. What an interesting guy, not exactly the vision I had of the traditional Archbishop of Canterbury. Tell us what makes this guy, Justin Welby, I believe is his name, so different.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great point. You know, what's great about these chapters that I went into, each one of them, I try to tell a story in each chapter. And the story there is what happened in England, which is interesting right now. So much church history happened in England because Henry VIII broke with the church over his marital infidelities. Yeah, I call Henry VIII the serial killer who founded a religion, you know, because he did right. Found the Anglican faith and he was the serial killer. I'm sorry.
That's right. You know?
But so that's what the Archbishop of Canterbury is the head of the church. And he also has a position within the state. He's appointed, you know, by the state, by the monarchy as the head of the church. It's a very unusual position. It's what the Americans rebelled against when we separated church from state, is we would not have these two intertwined. And now you've got this fascinating archbishop. Well, by the way, let's back up. So England now is very secular. And it's on a route, they think, where in 50 years, Christianity will almost disappear from England, which is astonishing, considering how much history happened. I don't know if that will happen, but that's what they predict. Less than 50%. Call themselves Christians now in England, but they still have the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. And he's struggling, you know, he's trying to figure out, he carries so much weight. He says he goes into the cathedral and he feels, you know, Thomas Becket's blood on his knees. He feels the weight of the centuries coming down on him. And yet he's sort of an honest, earnest guy trying to plead with his fellow Britons to open their minds, to look at faith fresh again. And it appealed to me, you know, because I was trying to look at my faith fresh, but you know, I went to the oldest church in the English speaking world, Bob, in Canterbury to start my journey, you know, set among these grave sites, these tombstones, you know, thick oaks that are 1,000 years old. And there's like, you know, 12 people in there. It's very sad. And they like seized me like vampires going for blood. You know, it was like, oh, a fresh human being. You know, they just grabbed me and they were so desperate. And my heart really opened to that. I feel that these people were earnest, wonderful folks, you know, trying to do right by their faith. But it just struck me, it had the sense of something that was disappearing. So Welby is really fascinating because he has this weight of history and he's trying to move forward as well.
I'm Bob Custer here at Reader's Corner. I'm talking with Tim Egan. He's the author of A Pilgrimage to Eternity, From Canterbury to Rome in Search of a Faith. At the outset of your book, you say it's time to force the issue. And the issue, I think, being believing or not believing, to decide what I believe or admit what I don't. Then at the end of the book, you say, I've resolved some things, but other matters will have to remain irresolvable.
Yeah.
What remains irresolvable after a journey like that?
I'm going to differ with you a little bit here in that I don't like to give away the ending to a book because
part
of a pilgrimage is to see what happens to the pilgrim on the way, you know, and which is what you do. I did set out to try to resolve some things. The problem with being a lapsed anything is that you stop thinking about it. And I think intellectually and spiritually, we as functioning, thinking human beings owe ourselves responsibility to always think about these things. And I just let my thinking go flat. I just let it go lazy. That was back in the 70s, the last time I thought about that. Oh, yeah, we all know this church. I thought, that's terrible. I mean, I'm just denying a huge part of my existence by, you know, not tilling the field of spirituality. So I was really determined. That's what's great about a pilgrimage is you have, you know, what they call deep walking. It was a term I heard on the Pilgrim Trail, where you're walking 18, 20 miles a day, and you're trying to think about one or two things. You're not checking the Seahawks score. You know, you're not seeing Trump's latest monstrosity or all of these things that I was always doing and I am still doing. You're thinking about a subject and trying to think about it 2, 4, 6 hours a day. So I did try to resolve some things. I tried to resolve my feeling about miracles. 80% of Americans believe in miracles. And, you know, I came to a really interesting conclusion about that. Probably not one that people would expect a journalist, a man of reason to come to. I came to some conclusions about faith that you can't, as some Jesuits tried to do, resolve it by, you know, mathematical equations and deductions. You can't resolve it by pure, you know, logical deductionism. So I did resolve some things. And I guess I'll spoil it for you here since you dropped it when you did. I did come to believe in the resurrection, which is, you know, what central tenets of Christianity, that Christ rose from the dead. And if nothing else, I see it as a grand metaphor of hope. And so, you know, I talked about three things at the end of the book that I saw that gave me faith in the resurrection. It was interesting. This is what happened on the Pilgrim Trail. I was in this Lutheran church in Switzerland with a guy from the Pacific Northwest who was the minister now in this ancient Lutheran church. I talked about the ambiguities of Martin Luther, who was a real anti-Semite, by the way. You know, right. Wonderful in so many ways, but said awful things about the Jews, which the Nazis later used to justify some of their crimes. And this wonderful minister said something in his Easter homily, and I was reading his sermons before I met him, so I knew about this, where he said, the message of Easter is love does not stay in a grave. And I kept thinking about that. Love does not stay in a grave. Love does not stay in a grave. And I found that to be a very powerful message. And so that's what I came, that's that. To give you a spoiler and all your listeners, I did sort of wrap my arms around the resurrection and see it as such.
You share with the reader your traveling companions, St. Augustine, like in the Confessions of St. Augustine, right, and Christopher Hitchens. On the other side of the equation, you might say, the late and well-known and published atheist. That sounds like a real theological tug of war. And I know at one point, maybe in more than one point in your book, you actually refer to this issue that I think believers and non-believers have always had to deal with, the question, why does God allow evil to exist?
Right.
And Augustine has an argument that I think you might have labeled imperfect or something like that. But why don't you share with us what Augustine, how Augustine treats that, or anyone else you ran across on the trail, I guess.
Right. So I respect Augustine as most, you know, intellectual Catholics or even anyone who's done a deep dive into the faith does. He's considered, you know, one of the founding thinking fathers of the faith. And, you know, his confessions, the book, The Confessions of St. Augustine, are a must read for anyone. And he struggled. His story famously is, you know, he was a libertine in his youth, and He said, Lord, give me chastity, but not just yet. You know? And he wanted one more go around before he gave it all up. You know, so he was really a conflicted guy. He had several women, several mistresses until he gave it all up and became a chaste man and advocated for that. But he did throw out several really fascinating arguments. And on the central argument that you bring up, Bob, why does a just God allow things to happen? I hope this doesn't offend your listeners, but I said it boils down to the it happens argument. You know, stuff just happens and, you know, you have to deal with it. And I just found that really lacking because, you know, it's, he also says that it's free will, that, you know, we have free will to determine good or bad within the things that God knows is going to happen. And Christopher Hitchens makes a counter thing saying, well, if he knew everything, why does he love this? You know, why didn't he make better beings of us? And I just found that, I don't know. I'm not a theologian. My whole approach to this book was average guy goes on a pilgrimage. So I certainly can't counter what the great theologians have said. But looking at Augustine's argument, I found it. I couldn't grasp it. I couldn't believe it because I don't think a just God would allow the monstrosities that I outlined. Let me just talk about those for a second. By the way, give you a bigger picture of this again. one of my conclusions, again, I shouldn't be saying this, is that faith itself fares very well, I think. And I really admire true people of faith doing good work and living by the central tenets of the gospel. And I meet them along the way and I talk about them along the way. One of my great heroes is Francis of Assisi. And this pope took the name of Assisi. But religion, unlike faith, organized religion does not fare well. And I don't know how a just God would allow an organization in his name to do things like the wars of religion. Now, I don't know how much you knew, Bob, about the wars of religion. I knew very little about them. In the Middle Ages, 15th and 16th centuries, right after Protestantism took hold.
Right. I learned from you.
Right. They killed 15% of the population of France and 20% of the population of Germany in Christian-on-Christian warfare. These were fellow believers in the Prince of Peace slaughtering each other over whose interpretation. Now, this was bound up in kings and monarchs and state loyals, but at its core, it was Protestant versus Catholic. Two different interpretations of this humble carpenter, you know, from Nazarene. So that's where religion does not fare well. How does a just God allow the Holocaust? I mean, how does a just God allow people to die of pandemics? And I just have trouble with that argument.
You mentioned miracles. The head of the ancient collections at the Library of Saint-Omer, you met him. He also is the guy who discovered the first folio of Shakespeare, the collected works of Shakespeare. He had an interesting take on miracles that you talk about in your book. Could you comment on just how he looked at it and what you thought of it?
Well, as I recall, now you may help me out here because it's been a while. In Saint-Omer, as I recall, the head of the ancient book collection there, who did let me into his wonderful den and show me these great 1,000-year-old manuscripts where the monks used to toil for a whole year to make one. His take was more on what has happened to religion in France, I think. And he said miracles were necessary then because, as I recall, he said something like, you needed miracles to further along the faith because it was struggling, but now you don't need them because the faith, you know, was not a struggling faith at the time. The more interesting take on miracles that I tried to deal with was, again, goes back to Augustine saying, and this meant a lot to me, you know, I was looking for miracles with the person I knew who was dying of cancer. And so at some point, that's all you have, you know. But he said, miracles are not contrary to nature, but only contrary to what we know about nature. And given that we only use a small percentage of our minds, and I've only used a small percentage of my soul, I thought that made a lot of sense. But in Saint-Omer, as I recall, he was more speaking to the historical reason to have miracles.
You're listening to Timothy Egan. He's the author of A Pilgrimage to Eternity, From Canterbury to Rome in Search of a Faith. Let's talk about the role of women in the church. Not necessarily the role of women today, but the role of women historically. And I wonder if you could, first of all, comment on Mary Magdalene and what I would consider the bum rap she apparently got in church history. And then maybe you could also mention the role that Pope Gregory VII played when it comes to priestly celibacy.
Right. So it's really interesting. You know, the issue of sex and the issue of women has really bollocksed Christianity for a long time. But it didn't have to be that way. And in the early phases of Christianity, it wasn't like that. So again, this is another example of how the institution took it and sort of warped it. They had, by almost all evidence, in the first century of Christianity, women ministered. They spread the faith. But even more important than that, Mary Magdalene was probably one of the top aides to Christ. We know most of the disciples were illiterate. They were largely working class. Peter was a fisherman, etc. Magdalene was educated, and she had money, and she was very close with Jesus. Now, these Gnostic Gospels, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with them, surfaced in the 1940s when someone found this giant discovery in a cave in Egypt in the Upper Nile. It was a 4-foot-high earthenware jug. And inside of there were, I think, 13 bound manuscripts dating from about the 3rd century. And those manuscripts related to Time of Christ tales. It told a fairly similar but just different enough version of the Gospels that we accepted. The most significant thing affected Mary Magdalene. And in the Gnostic Gospels, they said Mary was Christ's lover, that witnesses saw Jesus kissing Mary Magdalene, and that this was her lover. But this did not make it into the accepted gospels, which were, you know, sort of winnowed down about, I think, around the second century. As the church moved into a ministry of chastity, that priests couldn't be married and couldn't have sex, they started to write women out of the story. And so Gregory himself, single-handedly, Pope Gregory, you mentioned, took it upon himself to sort of cast Mary Magdalene as promiscuous, as somewhat of a whore, misreading this gospel passage. And from then on, she sort of assumed this lesser role. Now, my question is, what are they afraid of? Why is it bad to assume that Jesus, who had every earthly, he was a man, right? He had every single personality feature and defect that human beings have, except for lust. Apparently, sex just wasn't part of the human package. I don't find it that hard to accept. I mean, and again, these Gnostic Gospels show it. If you believe, it's logically consistent that Jesus was a man, and therefore he may have had a lover. I don't find that in any way taking away from the powerful message of the gospel. But this is, again, what a pilgrim discovers along the way when you think about these things and you take the time to think about these. How did this thing get so misguided and so hijacked? And only now are they trying to move it back a little bit. The Pope is saying about homosexuality, well, who am I to judge? Which was one of the most powerful statements ever said about a Pope. Pope Francis said that, or said by a Pope. And on women, there will eventually be female priests within the Catholic Church. It may take another two centuries. They will eventually go back to where they were in the early days. And again, Bob, this is something I can't stress enough. I'm not a theologian. I'm an average guy looking at faith. But if you look at faith, these questions come up about sex and miracles. And I'm not bothered by this. I'm not bothered by having my mind open to the Gnostic Gospels and the possibility that Christ took a lover.
You know, I don't even know what the Catholic Church says about the Gnostic Gospels. Does the Pope in Rome acknowledge them?
Yeah, well, here's what happened. The Da Vinci Code was a huge international bestseller. Right. And it's based on the passage in the Gnostic Gospels that not only did Christ take Mary Magdalene as a lover, but then this is where the fictional part happens. They then had children, and there's a descendant of this union floating around somewhere. So they had to react to that. And they said, no, this doesn't conform with the teachings of the church. But here's what's interesting. I mean, we all know that, you know, the Gospels were written up to a century after they happened. As a journalist, I have trouble recalling an event that happened a week ago. We can't decide on the presidential election what was true and wasn't true a month ago. How are they going to decide a century later what is canonical? So I don't necessarily trust Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John more than Thomas and, you know, the other Gospels, the Gnostic Gospels. But they had to winnow it down. The Catholic Church reacted fairly strongly to it, basically tried to pour water on it.
So I would definitely like for you to share with our readers your experience with St. Lucia Filippini.
Yeah.
She died in 1732. You saw her body encased in glass. Tell us what you saw about her body that was a bit strange, and maybe you could call it an out-of-body experience.
This is the strangest thing that happened to me on the pilgrimage trail. I still can't understand it, Bob. So I'll just preface it by saying that I'm still trying to process it. That's what I tell everybody. I try to be really honest with this. Look, I went into this thing. I'm a skeptic by profession. I've been a journalist for 30 years. I'm a Pulitzer Prize. I'm not going to go in and believe some hocus pocus, okay? But I was trying to be open-minded as well. So I get to within 40 miles of Rome in a town called Montefiascone. It has the third biggest Duomo, which is a, you know, dome church in the world. Most people don't know that. They know about the one in Florence. They know about the one in Rome, but they don't know about the one in Montefiascone. In the crypt there is the body of, and thank you for pronouncing her right, San Lucia Filippini. She died in 1732, I believe, at the age of 60 of cancer. She was a good woman by all accounts and was a saint. What happened was they put her in her tomb in the crypt, and her body did not decompose. It stayed fleshy. It stayed exactly as it is. Now, the Catholic Church has a term for this. They have some 200-odd instances where they say it's a miracle because the woman or the person lived a saintly life and their body didn't decompose. And that's what happened with San Lucia. So I went in on a dark and stormy night at the end of a long day, and I was this, you know, it was the dusk and truly thunder was going on, rainstorm. I ignored the beautiful church. I went right into the crypt and I was all alone. And I saw her from probably 20 feet out encased in glass. And I went inside the little ropes that keeps you separated. I walked slowly, step by step, until I got within 2 feet of her. And her eyes opened. I looked at it and I just gasped. I stepped back and I couldn't believe this thing. I took out my iPhone and I took a series of pictures as the eyes closed as well. Now, I then ran out of the church, you know, actually just sort of gasping, my heart beating. What did I just witness? So I got to say, her body looked really good. Now, she's, what, 380 years dead, and she looked fantastic. I don't know what her skin regimen was or what her treatment was or what embalming trick they were doing, but she looked really good. It did look fleshy. It did not look decomposed. But I hadn't had a glass of wine. I swear to God, her eyes opened. Now, I then later wrote a note to the archbishop in that region asking him to explain. He said, several people have seen the same thing. We don't do anything with the body. There's no manipulation. Near the second to last day in my pilgrimage, I was having a great, wonderful, informal dinner with other people we'd met along the way. We just sort of serendipitously all ended up at this one restaurant in this small town, and we were all having a great time. And I mentioned this, and this guy next to me, this Englishman, said, oh, he saw the same thing. And he pointed to this Russian physicist who was walking the pilgrimage trail for penance for his role in the Chernobyl nuclear disaster.
Oh, my gosh.
He felt like he had something to do with this awful, you know, Chernobyl, which killed a lot of people, you know, 30 years ago. And he didn't speak a word of English, though. So he kind of, we were translating, go back and forth. He claims he saw the same thing. Now, was it a miracle? I don't know. Why did it happen? My wife didn't believe it. She said, well, you know, if you want to believe that, Tim, that's true. I honestly, Bob, don't know how to process it, but yeah, I saw those eyes open. Now I looked at my camera pictures and unfortunately, like all UFO and Sasquatch pictures, they're somewhat inconclusive, you know.
Right.
See, you know, there's glare in the glass and it leaves it out a little bit. So it's not definitive proof. But I was very moved by that, and I don't know how to explain it.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's only natural that somebody who lives near Sasquatch would have a experience like that.
Yeah, exactly.
As far away as Italy. So I read somewhere, I don't know whether it was in that particular part of your book or whatever, that there's new guidelines on how you become a saint when it comes to miracles, and old versus the new, and that there's even a website that some guy came up with called miraclehunter.com. What is that?
Right. So this is a Stanford graduate. I mentioned earlier that 80% of Americans believe in miracles, which is extraordinary. And it tells you something about, you know, the faith we want to have and the belief we want to have. So this Stanford graduate started this website as a way to sort of verify miracles. And he's looked at 300 some odd instances of quote miracles. And he's, a handful of them, he said, you know, sort of qualify as miracles. The church itself has a long vetting process where in order to be a saint, you have to have miracles attributed to you. And it could be as simple as somebody praying in your name. That's what they're doing now with John Paul and having a miracle happen. But they send out these, you know, forensic experts to go do it. The one takeaway I have on this is that at Lourdes, you know, which is a sacred pilgrimage site where people have been cured, the British Medical Journal, I think Lancet, has looked at these miracles, these instances of people who went in with terminal illnesses, and found that about 80 of them, 80, over the last century or so, they cannot explain, that there's no medical explanation in the view of these doctors for why these people had, quote, miracle cures. And that's something I'm willing, when medical doctors at Lancet tell me that they can't explain that, that's not just, you know, somebody pronouncing a miracle one way or the other. It's something worth looking at.
Well, Tim, we've run out of time, but I want to tell you again how much I enjoyed the book. In fact, given the fact that we're so close to Christmas, this is a great Christmas present for somebody. A Pilgrimage to Eternity from Canterbury to Rome in Search of a Faith by Tim Egan. Thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
My absolute pleasure, Bob, and happy holidays to you and all your listeners.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.